on. Welcome to the latest edition of If You've Come This Far, where my friend Chris Lozier and I have conversations with just people we want to hang out with that we think are interesting and curious and for somehow agree to hang out with us. This will be our, we're not sure what episode
60th.
This is.
60th. Right? I've done the math. I'm calling it 60th, and we're going to plant the stake in the ground.
Oh, okay.
We're a mess.
Yeah, yeah. People already know that, though.
Who's running the show, Sean? That.
People already know that. They're like, you guys should just stop doing the intro.
Yeah, or stop doing math, right? That's the thing.
Well, you can't do that. You're all about math, nerd.
Perfect lead in for this.
Yeah, so we had an unbelievable conversation with Ashanti Branch, and maybe tell our listeners who Ashanti is, Chris.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll start by saying Ashanti is a former math teacher. I got connected to Ashanti just over a year ago, actually. I sat at an event for my organization next to one of Ashanti's colleagues, and he's like, hey, you got to talk to this guy. He's doing really good stuff with young men of color. And so we've tried for like I said, about 12 months to get together, and it was worth the wait because Ashanti is one of those guys who's just like willing to like devote so much of his life to a mission that he believes strongly. And the mission in this case is helping young men primarily, but increasingly young people. And I think even beyond that, people of all ages to be vulnerable and work on their sort of emotional sort of awareness. And he does it through an organization, a nonprofit he founded called the Ever Forward Club. And he's done a TEDx talk, which I couldn't recommend highly enough to the listeners. They're all good, like I said, but 10 minutes of a really powerful story. And I think the thing, Sean, you know, we talked about this a little bit with Ashanti, but I think what it was so appealing to me about having him on the show is that the work he's doing with that demographic is so similar to the work that we do at Men Living, helping men to be vulnerable and to open up and to be emotional and, you know, enough of this, you know, be a man nonsense that many of us grew up with. So yeah, it was one of those episodes where I was like moved several times where I was I got to get myself together.
he's a magnetic guy for sure. And so, I mean, it's easy to be connected to him and feel the passion. I think, you know, this whole idea of now, and he talks about it, using the mask as the symbolism for kind of being your real self and unleashing the emotions, both the positive and negative emotions that we have, letting, you know, taking the masks off is really, I think, a powerful metaphor for, you know, the work that we have to do. And so, so that in and of itself, I think is really cool. I mean, that's at the center kind of.
It is. And I'm obsessed with this idea, this metaphor is a tool of a mask. Cause even without taking the mask off, there's a win in acknowledging what's under the mask, right?
Right. Like,
there's the you that you want to show to the world. And then there's the stuff that you don't want the world to see.
Right.
So even if you don't take the mask off or flip the mask around or whatever, just being aware enough to know that, you know what, I'm not this person who's happy all the time or who's smiling all the time. And I do have self-doubt and I am anxious or I am lonely or whatever. So it's a beautiful concept and I think one that a lot more people could benefit from.
So it's just great. And he's doing work. And honestly, we didn't have enough time to go through everything. I mean, we talked a lot about origin story, which reveals a lot about Ashanti and how he is and who he is. But there's more to be talking about with him down the road.
Yeah. I mean, we say that about everyone and we mean it about everyone. But I hung up that from that call thinking, okay, I need some more of that. Right. I went into the call thinking I needed, having had a day,
right.
As I put it, I needed some of his energy. So it was good. So I think the listeners will hopefully feel, this guy's energy, because it's it's real and it's good.
Yeah, we hope you enjoy. We hope you enjoy it. We certainly did. So
for sure, here we go, Ashanti Branch.
Hello, hello,
hello,
Ashanti.
How are you?
We get very to good.
Good.
I can't believe we've never met, but I am so excited to be with you right now.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm Chris, and this other bald guy is Sean. I know Sean's excited too.
Well, I have to say, I'm doing a project with Daniel Ellenberg, by the way.
And I know
you're going to be hanging out with him tomorrow. So
fantastic. Are you working with the Compassion Network or something else?
Yeah, well, yes, the Compassion Network, and we're building a program for elementary school boys. So we got a lot to talk about.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, this is good.
So wait, before you start, when you say I can't believe we haven't met, I mean, should you have met already?
Well, I'll give you the backstory, and I wanted to warn Ashanti that we're already recording, because our goal is to have authentic conversations, and so literally nothing here is scripted.
Fantastic.
But I did want to start by giving a shout out to Ashanti, your colleague Parth, which is how we became connected, and this is over a year ago. So
yeah, Parth at the works, New Schools event.
It was at the New Schools 25th anniversary celebration, and Parth and I just happened to sit down next to one another, and we struck up this conversation, and he heard about this podcast. He's like, oh, you got to meet Ashanti, you know, this and that. And we hit it off. And so order of business number one, thank you, Parth. So the second order of business is to sort of confess, you know, shame that it's taken us this long to get together. But
dude, you don't have to feel any shame. You know,
shame is too strong a word.
You used it. I mean, just didn't work out. Schedules got all messed up. We're here.
And here we are.
Feeling
here
for
we
you.
Are.
Feeling good. Oh, well, I appreciate you, man. Thank you both. I trust that I've told, you know, this work we work in the schools, you know, you're always trying to like make things happen, and you're just like, why are they tripping? Right. Like even today on my podcast episode, we talked about a young man in Santa Clara, right? Who sadly died by suicide, you know, and freshman, only been in school 3 months, like football team players on his team, like bullying, right? Like just unacceptable behavior, right? But ultimately we know that a behavior exists, and that young man had no one to go to. And sadly, you know, we had reached out to the school. And so we were making progress. We were starting to lock in a date. They knew the freshman was struggling. Now I'm not blaming them, but I have this dance between trying to, how do you hold that inside, right? Where it's like, okay, you know, there's a struggle with that group of students. You know that they need some support. We're trying to like provide this support, and then the ball drops, right? And so, I mean, ideally no one wants students to harm themselves, and I don't blame, but it's like, okay, how do we help schools who know they need to do something, who don't have the capacity to do it, not try and be like, oh, we'll figure it out one day. Like, we're here to tell you, this is the work we do, you know?
So Ashanti, what are the barriers? Why will a school move so slow? I mean, what are you able to get over?
We're getting right into it here.
Yeah, we are.
We're diving right in.
So what are you able, because it's really, really important, and working with schools is really hard. So what are the barriers that you have to get over in order for them to adopt more quickly?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for us, there's not many barriers. There's mainly for us, it's like, look, if a school, we go to a school and they say, you know what, we don't have any money. We say, well, then let's do it.
Right.
Like we've never let money be a not reason to do a workshop.
Yeah.
It's never on that end. It's always like, if they have some kind of feeling like, oh, well, we don't know. We got to figure out the schedule, and we got to, well, like, let's make the schedule work. Let's figure out how much time are you going to give us to work with, right? Because as a former teacher and administrator, I know how complex schools. I don't want to come in thinking I'm just this workshop person who comes in and does workshops. Right. like I've been a teacher, administrator. Right. I've been a good student and a very right. bad student. So I know what it's like to be on all levels of this madness, you know? And so I think sometimes it's like they're just overwhelmed sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really have a heart for educators. So I've, even when I'm trying to hold them accountable, I do it in a very gentle way because I don't take it lightly and I don't think it's personal. But because this work is personal for me, it always feels personal.
Yeah.
When a tragedy happens at a school that we've been making progress with and then something drops the ball, like it feels like, okay, I take it personal. I take it personal. Like, what did I not do right, better? What could I have done better? Yeah. Like, because not that I would have even met the student when we went to that school, but to know that we were having real conversations and we made it happen in a school that knew they needed it. That for me is critical and it's crucial, you know?
How long had you been talking to them when this happened?
Well, I think that so we started doing work with them in May of last year. We started with Mental Health Action Day. That's how we met them. And then we did two workshops this year with smaller groups, with smaller sessions.
Yeah.
Then we were on the way. We were like, things were moving. And then it just hit a wall, right? Mm-hmm. And those walls are sometimes you can't see the walls. They're like invisible sometimes. Yeah,
right.
So you just, as a practitioner, you just say, okay, well, I trust that everything happens for a reason at the right time when it's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And then you just, when the emails don't start replying, you're just like, okay, maybe something happened. And sometimes it's like, you don't know if people, this is what the work is around the mask, right?
Yeah.
I think sometimes we don't know where the challenges are if people aren't open and honest about what it is, you know? So we're an outsider, right? As an outsider in schools, we're like salespeople now. I'm not trying to be a salesperson. I'm trying to be a person who makes impact and transform lives of young people. But ultimately, as a nonprofit leader, I have to keep the doors open.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I can't always be at the mercy of a grant. I need to be able to say, look, we regenerate our own revenue too. We need grants to help us keep this movement going. But we also, and if a school says we have no money, even if they're in a fancy place, we say, okay, let's make it work.
Let's go.
Because I'm never going to let it be about that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say for the record, again, I've only known you for 7 minutes or whatever, but I've been digging into you and watching you and everything else. There's a lot of shit I would buy from you. Like you could sell a lot of shit to me, man. you're just such a good communicator.
He's got a lot of merch behind him that
I know, he does.
You could just go to their store right now and buy a lot of shit if you wanted to.
Well, I feel like I've done a inadequate job of preparing you, Ashanti. You may not know that this podcast is part of a men's group. Maybe you do know this, that Sean and I are both have been involved in for a long time. It's non-faith based, but it's, I don't know, Sean, you can push back on this, but I think it's remarkably similar what we're trying to do with grown ass men to what you're trying to do with young men. And maybe that's why your TEDx talk and all the work that you're doing is so compelling to me. I mean, I've watched that darn look, there are not a lot of bad TEDx talk or TED talks. But yours is among the more meaningful ones that I've ever watched. I get, emotional all six or seven times that I've watched it. So I do want to give you an opportunity, though, to sort of set the plate here and tell us, about Ever Forward Club. I want to get into the masks in a big way a little bit later. And then maybe just tell us about yourself, because your story is pretty awesome as well.
Well, thank you for sharing about your men's team. First of all, let me just say thank you for having me. When I said a minute ago that this is, when I take it personal, I think this work is my life. Mm. Like I don't, this year, 2024, we hit our 20th year in Ever Forward. Like I never wanted to be a teacher. Like that wasn't my plan. Ashanti, growing up as a poor boy in Oakland, my plan was to be rich. You know what I'm saying? Like I went to college to be an engineer. I went to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. I started making good money. And this calling on my soul was so loud that I was like, what is going on here? Like I didn't go find teaching. My mom was a teacher, so I knew how broke teachers were. Mm. And I was like, I made a commitment at 15 that just one more time, she said, I'm not buying it. We got money for that. Money don't grow on trees. One of her sayings, all of her sayings about why she couldn't. No, you can't have that cereal. Get the one with the plain box. Like all the answers she gave about everything was about money. And I was like, this is dumb. And then when I found out my mom went to college, I'm like, you went to college and we're just broke? What is wrong with you? Like, what's wrong with your career choices? Because I promise that if I'm going to college, my family ain't going to be this broke. And I realized that my teaching was never my plan. And so that's the journey, is that it started with this calling for me from engineering to be like, you should be a teacher. And I'm like, nope, not me. You got the wrong house. So I ran. I made more money at a different job. Got a project manager job. And I was like, all right, now I'm making 20K more. This is fantastic. And then it wasn't long before my building caught on fire. And then something in me was like, what's happening here? Like, and I mean, that's more job.
So you were ultimately unfulfilled. Is that right? I mean, you were making bank, but you were empty. Is that right?
I was driving from Walnut Creek to San Jose, literally hour and a half, 2 hours a day each way.
Yeah.
Dumb. The dumbest thing. I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, why am I doing this? But I think clearly I thought money was going to answer all the questions of what would make me feel like life mattered. Mm-hmm. Because being poor for so long, I knew that wasn't the answer. So I was clear that, oh, wait, if you make a lot of money, live happily ever after, there it is, right? Go to college, get a good job, make a lot of money, live happy ever after. That's the American dream. And then when you start making money, why am I not happy?
Right.
I mean, I'm at happy hour every weekend. I don't miss a happy hour. You know what I'm saying? I got a spreadsheet for happy hour. Excel. Excel. You know what I'm saying? Like DOS. Like MS DOS spreadsheet. You don't miss happy hour.
You are dating yourself. You realize? Yeah,
right. I'm telling you.
That with MS DOS?
Oh man, look, it's dating me on myself. Yeah. I can't. Yeah. I've been trying to hide it. It just doesn't go away. And that's how it happened. So this teaching calling happened, and then I became a teacher, and I was doing a horrible job. Let me just say, like, I come to this teaching. I'm coming here. In my mind, I may be like only here for a few years, but I'm coming because it's calling me. I'm get this teaching, and I'm like doing a bad job the first year. Like, smart kids in my class are failing. I'm like, dude, you're too smart to be failing.
What were you
class.
Teaching? What were you teaching?
Math. Yeah. I was math. Yeah. FI high school math. So algebra.
Yeah.
So ninth grade, freshman, all three classes I taught. We had block schedule. So each class, an hour and a half. We got plenty of time to dig in. We're not rushing. We're not going like drill and kill. We're like deeply asking questions, inquiry based, project based learning. And I'm like, dude, you're too smart. For me, I recognize that, okay, if you're so smart and you're failing, then maybe I need to be doing something different, because I am clear that I'm only here to make success. I want you to be successful. I want to feel successful. And I didn't leave all that money to make these peanuts to be feeling like a failure. Like I said, I'm going to be broke, but I ain't going to be broke and a failure. You know what I'm saying? I ain't going to have a double whammy in my messed up life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Wait, Ashanti, I have a question for you. Like, who were you seeking counsel from in your life at that time? Or who was advising you on this crazy ass idea that it's, you know, you go to the front lines of education? And that's tongue in cheek, right? Like I adore and praise, my little brother's a teacher. Teaching is one of the hardest jobs in the world, underpaid, undervalued, et cetera. But it's not where you go to get rich or generate wealth, right? So who did you go to be like, hey, listen to my plan. This is what I'm going to do.
I went to my own wise counsel. I went to my own. I didn't have a mentor back then. I didn't even know what. I definitely didn't have a men's team. I didn't even know men's teams existed back then. I told my you know, fellow engineers, they were like, "Are you crazy?" They thought I was crazy. They tried to do an intervention. They're like, "Shanti's losing his mind. He's about to go become a teacher. Like, what's going on? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was really no. Like, who do you talk to when you're like, I think I'm going to take my education that I spent all this time and money on, and I'm just going to go get some more education and make less money.
Yeah.
I just feel good.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like I had become rich. I mean, if I had won the lottery and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go and take this free time of my life. Like, I was still just a young engineer. I mean, I wasn't wealthy, but I was making good money. I got paid all my bills in 1 month and still go out to Party on
happy
weekend.
Hour. Happy, yep. happy hour.
All happy the happy hours. Hours.
Yeah, right.
Every
did you,
happy hour.
Did you talk to your mom about it?
See, yeah, that because so I talked to her. I told her when I'd already applied and got accepted. Like I didn't tell her before.
Yeah.
Because I think deep down, like my mom, she couldn't help me go through college. She couldn't help me financially. Mm-hmm. There was no resources, but I think deep down she'd already planted all those seeds. I was the oldest. So I was raising kids before I even knew how to create one.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So yeah. My role in life was already being a nurturer. I was teaching my siblings how to do their homework. I was a teacher from the time I was 5 years old, making sure my sister didn't make a mess because I don't have to clean up the mess.
Yeah.
So we're not going to make a mess because you're going to have me clean. You know what I'm saying? So I've been teaching since I could figure out how to put words together in a good way, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think I taught her.
Oh, so we got all these questions coming at you from every angle. So you got in there, maybe not realizing how hard it is. When did you, how long was it before you had the come to Jesus and you're like, holy crap, I need help with this. Like
oh, it was a week three, week four. Like, I mean, it didn't take long. I thought I was going to be the cool teacher. I thought I was going to be the teacher who kids, they're going to love coming to my class. I'm going to be able to have fun. I was going to be like this middle school teacher I remember named Mr. Tong. Everyone loved Mr. Tong. I could never get Mr. Tong's class. I don't know why. They never put me in Mr. Tong's class. I got all the mean teachers. Everyone had Mr. Tong's class. Everyone loved. I was like, oh, I'm going to be like Mr. Tong. And I realized that trying to be the nice teacher, there's no respect. Like, I tried it my first semester. I was going to be the nice guy. Hey, y'all want to eat in class? Go ahead. Yeah. Y'all want to chew gum in class? No, go ahead. Y'all want to, you know, you need to go to the bathroom? Hey, don't worry about it. Just don't even ask. Just grab the pass and go. And I realized, oh, they're taking advantage of me. What? These little 14-year-old people taking advantage of me?
You.
Well, I mean, and I'm like, then I'm trying to get back, you know, somewhat of a little bit of control of my own classroom. And I got students talking to me like I work for them. And I'm like, well, I do kind of work for you, but I'm in charge here. You know what I mean? Like, and I realized that this is something's wrong here. Something's broken. And I said, okay. But I realized I had already let go of the reins way too much because it was just like, it was so much work trying to like get back. So I said, next semester started. I told students, hey, good morning. How you doing? Welcome to the first day of next semester. By the way, you can thank all your peers who were in my class last semester for messing it up for you because that guy who was here last semester ain't this guy this semester. And so guess what? Congratulations. And then
it was over.
And it was like, I didn't like being like that. I didn't like being strict and rigid and sit down. Don't move. Get up. Don't ask permission before you get up and go sharpen your pencil. I didn't like that, but I didn't, because I went from going to do whatever you want. I was like, no, you're going to do nothing. And then I had to find some balance. But what I did learn in there was that second semester, it was like, I'm doing a horrible job. Like, why are smart kids failing? And because I take it personal, I wasn't here for a job. I was here to make a difference.
Right.
I'm like, okay, something has to change. And so the vision of this Ever Forward dream was like, I'm like, okay, teachers were telling me, look, Chauncey, just don't worry. In about 3 years, it's going to be really good. I'm like, wait, wait, what? I got to be broke and a failure every day for 3 years before. There's no way. In my mind, I'm like, I'm going back to engineering. I'm like, I'm going back. Mm. And so my last effort, so in my mind, I had thought that I would start a club after I was teaching for a little while and get my wings under me. The club couldn't wait. The vision of the club, it was in my mind, in the back of my mind, like this mini fraternal organization. I was in a fraternity in college, but we didn't talk about feelings in my fraternity. We talked about parties and meetings and community service and parties and meetings and community service repeat, right? There was no talking about how you felt. There was no emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's not, I don't even think that's even on our website, right? Like the idea, I mean, it is now today, but it wasn't back then. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I think that what I realized was that I was going to start this thing for these young men because I wanted them to have a community, and I hadn't even had one myself. So in 2004, when I invited those young men to that first meeting, I was creating what I had never seen.
Mm-hmm.
But intuitively, something in me, something you can just say it was, I grew up in the church, so maybe it's like I had this idea that meeting people together on common accord, there's some power in there, there's some meaningful in there. I wasn't building it in a religious-based thing, denominate. It was just me trying to like help some young men find that they're brilliant, see that they're brilliant. Like I could see it in them, but in class I can't even tell them because they'd rather fight with me than have me tell them how smart they are. Because in that community, smart's not cool.
Did you see a problem too that they needed it, or intuitively were you just like, no, I think they need it, but they won't ask, or they're not, it's not obvious, or.
Yeah, I would say that I didn't know it existed. Yeah. I thought it was a wild idea that I was going to think about creating a club for these young men when I had never seen it. Now, if you go to the Boys and Girls Club, that's one thing. If you go to some kind of like, if you're on a sports team, that's a club kind of thing. If you're on a club scouts or something, but to be like, I'm going to start a club. This school had no clubs for young men that were just all young men connected and talking about stuff.
Yeah.
So I was like, I also knew that I was stretching because I hadn't even had my own experience like that. So I didn't even know that it was even a thing that I had a feeling that it could work, but I didn't know how.
Did you need it for yourself?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. Cause were you emotional? Were you an emotional guy? Were you a model for this out in your life with your friends or people that you met? Or was this going to help you be more emotional too?
I think that deep down, I'm a deeply empathetic person.
Yeah.
But I know the rules. So in my friend groups, depending on what friends they are, everyone who knows me knows that they can confide in me.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm a listener. I mean, I've been raising kids since I was a kid, right? So I know how to hold space for people who just need to vent.
Yeah.
But I know that my job is I never go first. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, okay. I watch the room. I read the room and I respond. We got to be tough here. We got to talk about sports here. We got to talk about wrestling here. We're going to talk about XYZ here. We talk about girls here. We talk about money here. Talk about success here. Talk about fame here. Okay, great. There was very few places where you're like, we're going to talk about feelings here.
Yeah.
So when you find a couple of friends who knew that it was a safe place to do it, then they made room for that. But I didn't always know that. So I think like I tried Ever Forward in 2004. I got invited to my first men's team in 2010. Okay. I had been running Ever Forward for 6 years before I even knew that it was things men's teams.
And you were how old when you started it? How old were you?
Let me see. Let me go backwards. I was in my late 20s. So I think, let me see. Yeah, I was in my late 20s. 74. I started in 2020. 2004, so 74, I was 30. It was my 30th year of life, 29. Okay. My birthday was that December.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, friends, if you're liking the show, please hit that follow button. And thank you to our sponsor, Judson & Moore, who distill, barrel, and bottle award-winning American whiskey right here in Chicago, Illinois. Every bottle reads, "Born from Boundless Curiosity." And having spent a few weeks of a sabbatical a couple of years ago working with this team, I can tell you that this is more than just marketing. So cheers to Colin, Elise, and the whole team at Judson & Moore for supporting if you've come this far. And now back to the show. One of the things I'd like to maybe explore with you is the story that I make up about you. Again, having not known you for long, but the story goes like this. You work 100-hour weeks. That's what I believe to be true. I also know you're an engineer. You've confessed to that a number of times already. So I know your math is sound. Nowhere in your calculus at this point, when you're like struggling to be a successful teacher, could you have been thinking, oh, I'll do this additional work with these young men and it'll be less work. So you must have known in your 20s that you were signing up for a way bigger deal, right?
Well, actually, I thought that it was going to make what I told the young man. I said, look, if you teach me how to be a better teacher, I'm going to buy you lunch once a week. I was thinking if I figured out how to support those young men who were causing me the most trouble in my classes. Mm-hmm. Now, trouble, it could be academic, social, emotional trouble. They were the ones getting the most trouble. If I can make my life easier with them, then it'll make my teaching job easier. That's what I was hoping that there was going to be some residual benefit to, like, if I could get these young men who are brilliant, but yet they're using all their brilliance for trying to make me look like I'm a fool, or they're trying to make me look like I don't know what I'm talking about. And the fact is, when I came to teaching from engineering, I had a potty mouth. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm talking about, like, I like and I speak what I'm going to say what I want to say. Clearly. And there'll be no ambiguity what I mean, what I'm saying. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think I'm a little smart too. I have a little ego, a big ego. And I'm like, you're not going to outwit me in my own classroom. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you're 14, I'm 20 something. Like, first of all, I'm a little bit smarter than you. A little bit. Maybe not a whole lot, but a little bit. Definitely, I got some words that I can pull out of this salad that I can make that will run you in circles where you're like, what did he just say? Because I can do that, right? And so I think I was a little bit like I want to win with you. I want you to win. But if you're not going to win, I'm not going to lose. You know what I'm saying? This is how it's going to work. And so I think it was like me and I was a reader. I started becoming, no, I wasn't a reader at that time. Was I a reader? Oh, yeah, I started reading a little bit more around that time. So I would like say quotes. I'd be like, listen, this person said this. And they'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're saying, right? And I'm like, that's the problem, because you don't do your homework. Yeah. That's why you don't know what I'm saying. You right. would know what I'm saying. And so I would like have this rhetorical. It was trying to be like, make it light, but it was more like aggressive, right? And I was like, this is not working. Like, that aggressive tone isn't necessarily working with them. I'm enjoying it sometimes, but it's not like it's making it better, you know?
How many boys were in your first group?
There's about, let me see, when we first started that first meeting, 12 young men, I think I invited like 20, 12 mm-hmm. came to that first meeting, at the end of the 2003-2004 school year. And then we came back in the fall. I told them, go home for the summer, create some ideas of what you want to do next year. Next year, we're going to kick off the first week of the school year. And then we started the club. And I realized that I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea how much work it was going to be. So we talk about the long days and long weeks. The fact that if I had thought about how much work it was going to be, there's no way in the world that I would have probably done it. And I think they said for entrepreneurs, right? You don't know how much work it's going to be until you look back and you're like, what the heck was I thinking?
I actually don't believe that. I actually don't believe that. Because just the story you're telling and just what you were doing. I mean, listen to me, I'm projecting on you, but I think intuitively you knew how much work it was going to be and you still did it. I mean,
I think the idea is that I knew it was going to be more, but see, imagine I didn't know. So let me carry. Okay. Here's the context. I knew it was going to be more tasky work, but here's what I didn't know. I didn't know how much needs those young people had.
Right.
So I had no clue what the reason they weren't doing their homework was because this kid was hungry. This kid was being abused. This kid lost his father 2 years before. This kid has a mother who's abusive. This kid is living on the couch of his uncle's house in the garage. Like, I didn't know what I was getting in. I just knew that it couldn't happen. As a math teacher, to get them successful at math, it wasn't going to happen in math class.
Right.
Because I needed to understand them a little bit more. So I think deep down, like, I thought it was going to be a little bit more work because I'm just getting lunch. Now, here's what I did. Here's all the other things that came along with it. How do you pay for lunch for 12 young men every week when you're making barely enough to survive yourself and you're not a nonprofit? You're just a teacher trying to do this and you committed to this. So they don't miss lunch. Right. Definitely when you're bringing lunch from off campus, right? They even have special requests. And you're like, holy, okay, wait, what's happening here? And I literally started realizing I have lost my mind or I'm losing it in the moment.
So that's makes me laugh so hard. I know it's not totally funny, but so I'm an engineer by education as well. I worked in the Navy on submarines, and then I went into the business world and I thought, oh, I'm good with numbers. But then I realized you put dollar signs in front of the numbers and I sucked at it, right? So it sounds like you fell victim to the same thing. So you were kind of making the shit up a little bit too, like you were right. Yeah. So I would love to hear you tell about some of those first meetings where you've got a bunch, I don't know, 15-year-olds, maybe 16-year-olds, in a room. Yeah. Like, how did you facilitate that? How did you get them to feel safe to be vulnerable? Like, how'd that go down?
So our lunchtime is 40 minutes, 45 minutes. So I got to get them. Now, for all the young men who are in their dating phases, it's really tough because they don't want to come, right? Even they don't want, you're going to miss, I only got 4 or 5 days a week. I got to spend one day there. So I'm like on the loudspeaker, young man, ever for it, get to portable 8 right now. Or I have the lady in the main office, Ms. Jones. And Reform members make it to Portable 8, right? The food is coming. So far, it was just getting them there. The second, once they arrive, they get their food. We do check-ins. And check-ins were just a whip around. How's everything going? What's good? What's not? What classes are you struggling in? That's how it started. What classes are you struggling in? So, hey, who's somebody struggling in math? Okay, who's taking that class? Okay, I need you to meet with them after school. So I was doing kind of like homework making. Like we were like matchmaking, like getting people help on what they needed. Because it started off with just making sure everyone got whatever they needed academically so they could be supported. Then as it began to get deeper around like, hey, what's happening? Because still, I'm new at this and I've never done this before. So I'm not going to be like, talk about your feelings. It started off with like getting people help on school.
Right.
Uh-huh. Then one week, a young man who was supposed to come to a session didn't show up. So I'm like, dude, where were you? Where were you last week? And so we had this little argument. He's like, well, I was trying to do, I said, dude, you're supposed to be here every week. We made it a commitment. You know what I'm saying? Now, I recognize I'm asking for a lot from them, but I'm also thinking I'm giving a lot, right? So I'm like, it's a win-win. And then he's like, and why are you always on my back? And I'm like, well, you're mad? And I remember this conversation kind of went to a place where it was like, I want to be mad too. Because you don't know how much it's coming out of the last bit of savings I got in my savings money is going. I didn't prepare for this. I didn't prepare to leave engineering. It called me and I tried to run from it. And so I was not thinking I was eventually going to. So I had a little bit of savings, but I didn't have 12 months worth of four lunches a month for 20 young men.
Yeah.
I didn't have that kind of savings. It started eating up quick and it was nothing replenishing it. So I'm like, you don't know how much I'm mad too that I'm making this commitment. And I know because at the time I wasn't starting a nonprofit. I was a teacher trying to do this thing that I was trying to do to help them. And so in the moment I was like, hey, don't be giving me no attitude. Like, and I think that in that moment it was like you're mad, I'm mad too. But actually I'm more, and I think we were just in a place where we were both trying to test the water of how much can we be honest. I'm actually probably, if I was being honest in that moment, I was probably more sad. I felt disrespected. Yeah. I felt unappreciated. But I didn't have that language even myself then. So I'm like, you mad? I'm mad too. Like, I'm here sacrificing for you. Uh-huh. And I think that moment was like, if we're going to have real talk in here, if you make a commitment, you keep your commitment. I keep my commitment to you. And it started to be like those kind of conversations began to deepen our connection. And sadly, it had to come out of anger because we didn't know how to navigate feelings. I had no feeling language. Even though I was trying to run this program, I wasn't running a program about emotions and feelings. I was running a program for young men to have a safe place to just kind of connect. And that's when those early kind of conversations started happening, I realized, oh, there's more going on. Mm-hmm. It's not math related. It's all the barriers that's getting in their way. Yeah.
And why was it that you focused on just the boys? How did that come about? I mean,
They were the ones that were struggling the most.
Yeah. And how much has changed in 20 years?
Man, I wish I could say more.
Is it worse? Do you think it's worse now than it was then?
I would say, here's what I think has happened in a lot of ways. So we began to have these conversations around young men and emotions, which they're not having.
Yeah.
This is before there are these supercomputers in their pockets.
Yep.
Right.
So imagine we're having real human conversations together. We're starting to break down these walls that I don't have to have it all figured out by myself, that I can talk about how I feel. It's human to feel. It's not manly or women. It's human to feel. And when you don't be showing your full humanity, then you get treated like a monster.
Yeah.
And what happened when they do with monsters? They put monsters in cages. That's what we talk about with them. So when we first started talking, it was me just saying, we're having a conversation. There was no distraction in the meeting. I mean, the distraction in the meeting was somebody knocking on the door saying, hey, come out and talk to me. Now, they all got supercomputers in their pockets. And not just the device, they're vibrating in their pockets. So they are checking it every time it vibrates. So their presence is limited. Because they're trying to be in the room, but their mind is in their pocket about who's trying to call them, who needs them. And that dopamine is so addictive that now, so I think that you know, we get better in 1A because we have more men than ever before talking about emotions, and yet we have more distractions than ever before to pull you away from talking about those emotions. And so I imagine that, you know, you can't make one thing stay still while you fix the other, right? You're trying to optimize for one, and you, and then the other, you, so you end up with one wing that's just flying around in circles. So I think as we began to give, imagine if men still today didn't talk about emotions like we do.
Yeah.
I mean, in a world where we're just locked into this madness, I love my phone, but I'm really just being clear. Like, if we're not careful, we can make that our litmus test for our value in the world.
For 1,000%. And I also would say, I think that if we can do a good job of having those conversations, of talking about emotion, it can help us deal with this thing, technology that we're so addicted to, and maybe be less addicted to it, because what's most important is this kind of stuff. Even though we're on, you know, you're in California, he and I are in outside of Chicago.
Yeah.
We can still connect here. It's still, there's some intimacy that's not going to be had on those devices for sure.
That's right. So different. So different.
I'm curious when you first started, were there any other guy teachers in the school, and did you try to recruit them to help you out in any way?
Okay, so here's how to take apart. So in 2006, 2006, I started 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004. Okay. So 2002, I started teaching. By 2007, I qualified to go on a Fulbright fellowship. And so my vision was that I was going to, first of all, were there many male teachers? There was very few. I was the only African-American male teacher. And I think there was maybe five other, there were three PE teachers. One, two, three, maybe less than 10. So very few. The deeper part of that is that when you imagine that there are so few, and I'm not only a male teacher, but I'm also somewhat of a hothead from Oakland, California, like I can always be seen like the too aggressive one, right? So I was oftentimes in the principal's office myself because I said something to a kid that was seemed to be a little too out of pocket, right? So I got called to the principal's office myself, you know, even as an adult.
Shani, that's got to be your wrestling background there coming out, right?
For sure. And I always got a mask ready, handy, just in case I got to transform into another character. You know what I mean? I'm always prepared. just say the word. It's on. But but it's also that rough edge, that teacher trying to, I think if I was looking back when I was doing some thinking about this the other day, I was like, I think I was trying to be a difference between the Jaime Escalante, the math teacher from South Central, who was funny and pithy and aggressive, right? And Joe Clark, right? From Lean On Me, right?
Yeah.
Like I wasn't the principal, but I was going to act like it, and I don't have no bats, but we're going to throw down, you know? And so I was trying to be edgy, but not edgy just to be edgy. That's who I was. And I was coming from an engineering background where you're out in the construction field. You're like, hey, what's going on here? You're not whispering. I don't have a whispering voice, right? So when I come to teaching and I'm loud, people are like, why are you yelling? I'm not yelling. I'm just talking. Like, this is the way, this is the way you talk. Right. What do you mean? I'm just projecting my voice. What do you mean? And that it was seen as like I was always yelling at people. But I wasn't. I was just a good projector. So when I got accepted to the Fulbright Fellowship, I was going to be leaving, and I was trying to find somebody who wanted to do it, but there was that person, the PE teachers were already doing their coaching. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Because I knew I had to have somebody take over the club. And I think I may have asked a couple of male educators, but I don't think they were biting. And I was like, okay. By that time, we had three clubs. We had Ever Forward, which was for the young men. We had the Ever Forward Chicas, which was for the young women, and then we had one that was called Siempre Adelante, and that was for all the newcomers, because that community had a lot of newcomers. Okay. So they were students who were learning language, and so we had three clubs at the time. Now, not just one, we had three that I somehow thought I knew what I was doing. Now, I wasn't running the young women's club until the leader of that club kind of fizzled out, and so then I'm like, I gotta find somebody. So luckily there was this teacher who she took over. And so I go to India. I'm in India 3 weeks. I get to India in July. School starts like August. I get there. My president, the young man, calls. He says, we got a problem. The teacher's not coming to the meetings anymore. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean she's not coming to the meetings? Well, she said, y'all got to figure it out on your own. And so basically, she thought because Everfor was doing so good that somehow that the young people were leading the charge.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like they were making it all happen. Now they were coming to meetings, but I was the coordinator of the orchestra, you know? And I think sometimes from outside, it looked like the students were just self-motivated. And I think deep down they wanted to be, but some of them hadn't found the self-motivation yet. Yeah. And so literally she was like, I can't do this. I can't, they don't come to meetings. I'm like, of course they come to meetings. Just go in the loudspeaker and call them. Like, what do you mean? And she thought it was like autoplay. She thought it was like autoplay. And I was like, I made it look too easy.
So so you started the first one, which was taxing. And how many, and 2 years later you had three clubs? The next year you had three clubs?
Yeah, by the time 2007 came.
I love you because that is the classic, you know, the entrepreneur is like, I'm just doing more. Are you shitting me? I'm just doing more.
Yeah, that's all. I'll just do it.
I'll figure it out.
It called.
No shit.
I didn't plan to do more. There was a need.
You can't help yourself. Right.
You can't ignore it. Now, by 2007, so I still haven't joined my own men's team yet, right? That's 2007. I come back 2008. I get the club back running. We moving things in shape. And then I think in 2008 is when I had my first, I'll call it a panic attack. Now, back then, I thought I was getting sick. But I didn't know what it really meant. I think the first one was actually before I left India, and the second one was when I got back. So I'm in my classroom. Like, remember, I told you, I didn't know that all the young men were going through was I was taking it. I was carrying it.
Right.
I didn't have a place to let go of my own stuff. Yeah. So I'm carrying their stuff and my stuff. This is the one before I left. And I remember I had an IWE, which is like a student worker. We're doing a circle with my students in my class because we would do circle work with my students in my class too. And we're doing this activity and they're letting go of their stuff. And I'm just like carrying it. And I remember toward the end of the day, I looked over at him and I said, hey, call the office. I'm about to pass out. I don't know what was happening. I just knew like energetically, I was losing consciousness. And he said, what? I said, go to the phone, call the office, tell them to send an ambulance because I'm about to pass out. And he's like, are you serious? I said, go do it. So the students are doing their check-in around the circle. They're doing the check-in when the last person goes. I said, you know what, folks? We got about 20 minutes left. You know what I'm gonna have you do? I'm gonna have you, we're gonna pack up. You're gonna leave the desks where they are. I'm gonna have you all go outside and just wait outside. I'm gonna let you just get some fresh air. Now, here's what students know about Ashanti Branch. First of all, Ashanti Branch's rule is that the bell doesn't release you, I release you. So they know that when a bell rings, don't start moving toward the door or it's gonna be worse. So they know. So the fact that I'm letting you leave before a bell is even thought of, it's like it's starting to get a little tricky. Like, what do you mean? I said, they thought I'm tricking them. They said, you trying to trick us? Yeah. Like, no, I want you to go outside just because my room was a portable. So there was, you know, outdoors outside. Yeah. So go out, get some fresh air. It was a beautiful day. Go outside, just hang outside. And as soon as everyone got out, I said, get your bags, get everything. No, it's okay. Go outside. No, you can't stay in here. Go outside. And as soon as they all got outside, I laid on this beanbag on my floor. And I was like, oh my God, I'm thinking about that. And I hear students saying, what's going on? Why? What's going on? Like, you could hear them like questioning, and literally, I start hearing the ambulance come, and I'm like trying to just keep it together. I'm trying to keep it together. And I think when I look back, so long story short is I end up at the hospital. The students are like, I hear students like, what's going on? And then I'm at the hospital in the emergency room, and I hear kids in the hallway like, we're looking for Mr. Branch. Oh. Like they're trying to kick the kids out. Some kids that came up to the school. These are kids in Everforward.
Yeah.
And it was that moment I'm like, what the heck? Is that here? Do I hear? I hear Corbray's voice and I hear Erica's voice. I'm like, hey, I'm in here. And they come in, the hospital police are like, get out. They're like, no, we're here to see our teacher. And they all rush in the room. And I'm just like, oh man. And it was that one moment where you're like, something I've been doing is right.
Yeah.
Now we had a fundraiser the next day. We had a fundraiser. We had a, like, remember, I'm paying all this out of my pocket. We have three clubs. I'm still trying to, we're trying to do a little fundraisers here and there. I'm like hemorrhaging, literally. Maybe that's what was happening in my body, but I'm definitely in my accounts. And I said, hey, okay, I'm so glad y'all here. I said, you know what? We got this fundraiser tomorrow. I'll meet y'all at the, they said, Branch, we canceled the fundraiser. I'm like, what?
Now I'm having a heart attack too.
It's like red line. What did you do? We got all the students together after school, and we told them that the fundraiser is canceled, that we were going to come up here and see you. Don't worry. They're telling me not to worry that it's canceled. And I'm saying, the worry is that it's canceled.
Right.
Like, I'll make it to the hospital. I'll make it to the bowling alley tomorrow. We're having a bowl-a-thon. We're like, how are we going to pay for this food? We weren't a nonprofit. And so I think it was that moment of like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but something I'm doing is working.
Yeah.
I was upset, but kind of, you know, kind of in a funny, but also like, what do you mean you're canceling the fundraiser?
Yeah.
They did exactly what their hearts told them they needed to happen. Sure. Right. And it probably made sense that they canceled it, right? But all I could see was like, that means no revenue this month. What are we going to do? What am I going to do? Yeah.
That's an overlooked metric of success right there, right? Like you got these kids to believe, right? And to think, okay, I see they were hopeful, right? Like, and you were a symbol of that.
But Chris, arguably that's what you're in business for, right? I mean, you're not in business to increase the, you know, the earnings of the shareholders, if you will. You're in, you know, you're in business to do that, to make change, to have an impact.
Totally, I agree. No doubt. And I would love to go into like, how do we scale the Ever Forward Club? But I wouldn't forgive myself if we didn't get into the notion of the mask. I think it's the most elegant metaphorical tool for vulnerability that maybe maybe you didn't come up with it or whatever. I feel like we've used similar types of exercises before, but maybe you can tell us a little bit about the genesis of that and how you rolled that out, and maybe just tell the listeners what I'm talking about in the first place.
So I have one here I'll share in a second. So, fast forward. So I leave that school, go to my Fulbright Fellowship in India, come back from India, end up leaving that school at the end of that next school year. I go to Marin County, which is a fancy part of the Bay Area. I work at a private school there as a math specialist, come back to Oakland, work at a charter school, get my admin credential. I then become a dean at my former high school. And then I'm on my way to like learning about administration. My first year, my first job as a dean. And what's happening is these young men are struggling at this school. This is my old school. And I know this school intimately now because I'm from this school. And there were students who were getting kicked out of advisory. Now, advisory is not, in most schools, are really a class. It's like a place that a teacher, it's advisory. You get advice. You get advice. You probably need some advice. You probably don't want advice. You get advice anyway. Like advisory. Kids are getting kicked out of advisory. And I'm like, how do you get kicked out of the class that has no work? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And so these young men were struggling. So anyway, long story short, we get invited to be a part of this documentary. Now, I don't know what the documentary is called at the time, but I know now it was called The Mask You Live In. When they asked if they come film, we had already had a club at the charter school I was at. That was, the club was strong. Those young men were on fire. I had already joined my men's team. We incorporated some of that stuff. Like, I started getting better at this thing. All of a sudden, I'm saying, this is beautiful. They said, no, we want to know where you are. I said, well, I'm at my old alma mater. And these young men, they don't open up. Like, they'd rather have a fight than open up about their feelings. They're like, oh, we'd rather be where you are. I said, well, you should, as long as you want to see resistance, because all you're going to get is resistance. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, okay. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, they're going to come here. These young men are going to start a fight because we're going to try and talk about feelings, because it's easier to talk about fighting and talk about and be angry than it is to be emotional. And it wasn't until like maybe a couple of days before they were coming, I said, what if I just don't make them talk about it? What if we don't talk? What if we make it a silent experience? Now, they love to talk, but every time you try and talk about feelings, everyone wants to be like, man, you're trying to make me into, they say they'll come up with a fight, a fighting point.
Right.
So I said, what if you don't have to talk about it? What if they just write it? So in the first activity I did, I just printed the masks out. It was just these ski masks or whatever. And I asked them to write the words on the front and back. So the mask, what we describe it as is the three words on the front, which is the things that I gladly let the world see. It's the front of the mask. And three words for the back of the mask, things I don't usually let people see. And in the documentary, it was just write as many words as you have you can in the few minutes we have. And so then we took those papers, we balled them up, and then we threw the papers at each other. And what we experienced, what they experienced in that moment was this idea that when they opened up that paper, they had somebody else's paper, and they read off these words, and I think it just, the room dropped. I mean, literally, we hadn't even said a word yet. The room dropped in. Like, I tried everything I had. All my good stuff was like, they were like kryptonite to my good stuff. They were like, everything I tried was like, boom, fight, boom, argument, boom, this, like, what is happening? And this activity where I was like, we don't even have to talk yet. And man, when they started looking at those words on the back of that paper, that was like their words that they didn't write, it happened. And I literally, I was in that moment, I had never seen it work with them. So I don't even know what to say, because I don't even know how to respond to them being solemn, them being caring, empathetic, them being quiet, introspective. And literally that activity absolutely has changed my life. I mean, and I think that it was like all the things I had tried before, and the thing in that moment was like, this is my last straw, and an opportunity to show something to the world that I think I know why I'm doing this work. But if you looked at how it was working up until that point, it wasn't working. And I they wanted to see it anyway. And luckily that moment, it worked like it never did before.
Ashanti, did you fill out your own mask on that?
Oh yeah.
On that day?
Yeah.
Do you remember what it said, or would you be willing to share?
I don't know, but I have one here. I've made hundreds of masks, if not, I don't even know how many hundreds of masks I've made. So the front, like, this is one that I've made here recently. So this is the mask on top, and the three words on the front, I wrote smart, caring
and prepared. Yeah.
And the back, the things that I don't talk about much, I wrote tired, ineffective, and self-doubt.
Yeah.
In the beginning, I was probably using the similar words, but then I started to be really clear, like, because I want also to be able to, when I'm talking to people, when I'm talking to young people, I'm like, do you know that I see you? Like, do you know that I see you?
Right.
Do you know what it's like to be seen, you know? I'll show you one from a teenager. This is a little booklet we made a while. Here's one that's probably, I want to make sure you can read the writing. Some of the writing is not as neat, but yeah, I'll show you this one. And you can't read the words on the back, but you can see it. So this is the front of the mask. It says happy, smart, outgoing, and caring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this word on the back is the word that's bleeding through. But if you go close, you probably can't see it, but I can tell you what it's written. It's written 18 times, the same word.
Yeah. Anger.
It says anger.
Anger.
Yeah. 18 times.
Yeah.
And that's what we see with so many of our young people, definitely our young men. They're bottling up all of this stuff. They're smart, happy, outgoing, caring on the outside. And inside, they're bottling up. And what's happening is it's just reaching the breaking point.
Yeah.
And all it takes is one thing. Somebody steps on their foot, looks at their partner, calls them a name, ignores them, and boom.
Yeah.
And you're like, what happened? What happened? What happened?
Do you still do the exercise where they crumble it up and get someone else's mask, or do you work up to the point where people can share their own mask?
Yeah, in a workshop, we don't go there. We actually intentionally collect them really quick after they make them. Now that we use the card, so now it's a movement. It's called the Million Mask Movement. Yep. So originally we were just making masks. Now it has a name. So we actually, if we have like an auditorium, we get volunteers to collect them all. We bring them all up, and then we let the students, I don't touch them. I really do a really intentional thing so they don't think I planted any cards. Sure. I never touch the cards. And then we pass them out to the volunteers. And then the volunteers read one word from the front and back. And they, in that moment, it's that passing them around. But if it's too big, you can't. But we have a lot of people who are making masks with youth around the world. And now that, and this movement is growing. We've been trying to, I've been trying to make it grow. And this year has finally started to take off. And it's been really beautiful. We created an advocates group for young men. And so in this community called School, S-K-O-O-L, S-K-O-O-L. And that is a way for us to like engage people who care about young men and really trying to say, well, how do we have a conversations about these topics? Because we know that they're struggling. Mm-hmm. We see the data. We see the young men struggling. And oftentimes people are just like, where do I go? Where do I go? So we're trying to like build that out, you know? And that's the next step of this work. You know, that's the next step. So,
curious, Sean, let me go real quick and then we're shut up. I promise. This is what Sean, this is what happens a lot. I have to, you know, ask forgiveness. Cause I'm an interrupter. But I'm curious what feedback you get from the young people who participate in this in terms of, I don't see how it couldn't be moving to people, even if it's, you know, you're not reading your own card, but like, do they report being better able to share and flip their mask around and not, you know, have the two-sided mask or what do we think is happening and what do we hope happens?
Yeah. So at the end of that part, we ask people, what did you feel? What are you feeling? What did you notice? And I think students begin to notice that, wow, intellectually, people would know, yeah, there's more going on with people than you can see. But we operate based on what we see all the time because we're using this device as a way of putting information out. So we're like, oh, I saw it, and therefore that's how it was. Or I interpreted what I saw and what I make it mean. I think that the work is young people come up and they share out loud. They're like, man, I didn't realize that so many people in here were going through this much stuff. I thought it was just me. It's so good to feel I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. It's so good to know that other people understand what struggle is, even though they may not show it. And I think that those kind of reflections are the deeper ones that where we recognize that, okay, it's sinking in. And so it's a seed planting, right? When we do an assembly with 200 students, we're planting seeds. And we're just hoping that the school will be a part of the watering of the next season of it, of covering more conversations.
That was just going to be my next question is the seeds get planted in the workshop. And so how do we make sure they get watered? I mean, one of the things that we're pursuing right now is we want to build an army of strong men with love in their hearts to go out and change the world. And that means, you know, engaging those young men and boys in ongoing and conversation and engagement and communication so that you're plant, because that's my question is you do a workshop, you plant the seed, then what? Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful in and of itself. But let's be honest, unless you're doing the reps, is it really going to stick? And so how do we do that? I mean, I'm getting chills talking about it because I think there's an opportunity to do that. But how do we do it and get after it? Because, you know, that the boy that you talked about at the beginning of this conversation, there's a lot of that happening every day. And so how, you know, we're sitting here and we're doing the best we can, but there's more we can do, I think.
And I think what you know is that, and you probably, as you're talking about it, once we get these men who are ready and who are committed to it, it's like, okay, then how do we go, what fortress are we going to try and break through? Are we breaking through?
Deploy them, right? Where do we deploy them?
That's right. And I think sometimes schools are, sometimes it's hard enough to get schools just to do the planting seeds.
Yeah. I'm sure, so you're like, absolutely. That was the question I was asking you at the beginning about barriers. And so we have to get crafty in our you know, war plan, if you will. How do we break those barriers?
That is the magic question.
I mean, like, I want to be empathetic too, like to teachers and to school leaders.
A thousand percent.
They've got so much that they're expected to do.
1,000%.
And this is not an excuse at all. And, you know, like at New Schools, we promote this idea of an expanded definition of student success, which is it's not just about cognitive growth, right? Yeah. It's about social emotional learning. It's about safety. It's about vulnerability and all those things. So it's working, right? It's working.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you said is very powerful. Like the people who are the philanthropic people who have resources, it's also like, look, and this is maybe like this is tricky. It's tricky. Every time you talk about nonprofit stuff, it's kind of tricky. But let's just say the organizations that have been around for hundreds of years, right? The big ones, right? The Boys and Girls Club, Big Brother, Big Sister. Those are amazing organizations. The hard part about innovation is that you got to be able to get some resources to prove that it will work. Right. Yeah. And most people are afraid. They say they want to be innovative, but if I say the only way you can, if the innovation is I'm going to get kids to come somewhere after school to then hopefully be able to talk positive things about them, great. Well, we've tried those things for lots of years and they do work.
Right.
But if we don't say we're going to go to the school and reach the students who are not going anywhere after school, who are hanging out on the corner after school, who are hanging out with the wrong crowd after school, then we are saying, well, we're going to leave the school to figure it out. And then you can see what happens in some schools. There's not all healthy adults in all schools.
Right.
And so therefore we have to begin saying, okay, if we're going to break through that fortress, then it's layers of like bureaucracy we got to deal with, because the men who come to help, they don't want to be dealing with all the red tape and stuff. And so you've been like, right, okay, how do we, so I think I'm ready. I'm in this battle. Yeah. And so however we're trying to do it every step of the way. And we know that it just takes all these little seeds to keep. We need some waterers. We need some fertilizers. We need some, we just need a lot of extra hands in the garden, you know?
Yeah. Yep, agreed.
Well, I feel good knowing that you're doing the work that you're doing. I feel like our time is too short here. And hopefully we can stay in touch, maybe get you back on to expand this conversation some more. Yes. I would like to promote Ever Forward Club some more and figure out how we can help scale that as well. Do you have 4 more minutes for 3 canned questions that we ask every one of our guests?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. The first question is, what do you wish, Ashanti, you could have told your 10-year-old self?
Yeah. Ooh, okay. Here we go. Hey, Ashanti, that thing that happened to you when you were 8, I know you can't tell anybody about it, but just know that you're not alone. Just know that it's going to be your superpower in the future. So when you're ready, let it go. But until then, just know that you're still alive. You're still here. It's for a reason. It's not going to make sense for a long time. But as soon as you're ready to talk about it, just know that you're going to be safe. Hmm. That's what I would have told him.
Hey, let me regroup here. Second question is, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
We tell people at the end of our workshop, there's more to you than anybody can see by just looking at you. There's more to me than you can see by looking at me. So ask questions, be curious, be kind. Don't assume.
But curious is one, like if my next tattoo is going to be curious, not judgmental, for sure. So I love that you share that. All right. Last question. We're going to let you go, because I know we've kept you too long and it's been a joy. But what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
Thank you for waiting. Thank you for saving the tears to the end. I appreciate it. He gave his best. He sacrificed his own joy sometimes to make life better for others. He didn't have kids, but he chose to be there for any other kid who didn't have parents. And I'm thankful that I had him in my life. Mm.
Ashanti, you're a gem of a human, man. Thank you. Lucky that I got to sit next to Parth, and then we got connected. So let's definitely stay in touch. And thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks for asking. Thanks for the beautiful conversation. It was
a real joy. Too quick. Too quick. It was great.
All right. Well, we're looking at, you know, wherever the need is, we're ready. And the Million Mask Movement is free for people to use. So, you know, millionmask.org.
Yep.
Three steps is anonymous. And however, we want to serve wherever the need is. So thank you for having me.
We know you do.
Yeah. All right, man. Sending you love out there in Oakland.
Okay.
Peace
be well, man. Good to see you. Have a great meeting this
week. Thanks, Shanti. Take care.
Cheers.
Bye.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out at menliving.org.